our examiners that issue these. It's a really common question. I think the challenge is that the options available are not utilities that are as common, things such as a landline. And so I think that having this as an additional qualifier is just an option for individuals to prove residency. The address would still have to align. And under Real ID, this is something that the state can allow. And so that is the request for including it.
Senator Pratt.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I understand, Mr. Zhang, that you know, things like landlines are less prevalent than they are today. I would say that nearly every residence has electric, gas, sewer, and water going to it. And the reason for my question is that I worked in fraud prevention for a couple of large financial service industries here in the city. And one of the biggest areas of fraud was we found fraudulent utility bills of somebody trying to say, nope, this is my address, this is where I lived. And we actually found out that the bills were fraudulent. They were counterfeit or mocked up in some way, shape, or form. It's not a real reliable way to begin with. And now when we look at the technology of not actually having to have a wire to a primary, to a physical location, to me just makes it even a little harder to trust that source. And so I'd be happy to follow up with you online, but I'm not, unfortunately, with today's technology, utility bills are being used to defraud large financial institutions. I'm suspecting they're being used to fraudulently prove residence as well.
Any response, Mr. Zhang, or should I move on? There was no question there. I just wanted to give you a chance to respond if you wish.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Pratt, we're happy to continue that conversation. Again, the proposal is a request that we're seeing from constituents, from customers, and that was the intent of including it. But I acknowledge that they're fraudulent concern, and that it is document fraud is a big part of what we review when we see those applications. So certainly something that we're concerned about as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions from any members? And I am not seeing any. Senator Coleman, any final comments on your bill before we lay it over?
No, Mr. Chair, members, just thank you for giving it a hearing, and thank you to my testifiers.
Thank you, Senator Coleman. With that, Senate File 3139 is laid over. The next item on our agenda is the presentation by the Department of Public Safety with their supplemental budget presentation. Mr. Zhang is on as a witness, as is the commissioner. Nice to see you again, commissioner.
Thank you, Chair. It's
welcome
always a
to
pleasure.
The committee.
Thank you very much.
Who's going to go first, you?
I think I'm starting this.
All right, Mr. Commissioner, you know the rules. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please proceed with your presentation.
Absolutely. For the record, my name is John Harrington. I'm the commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. And members of the committee, I'm happy to be here with you today. The mission of the Department of Public Safety is to serve all communities by building a safer Minnesota. And our bill and our approach to this has been very mindful of that. We are building a safer Minnesota as we move along. The Department of Public Safety is unique, at least I think it's unique. It's certainly been unique in my experience that we serve out and are funded out of two different committees, so that we have our funding coming through your committee, sir, and also through the Public Safety Committee. And if we think about how those two overlap, there is a great deal of back and forth between the two. On the public safety side, we have alcohol, gambling, and enforcement, the Fire Marshal's Office, the Office of Justice Programs, Emergency Communications Network, Homeland Security, and the BCA, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Why this gets complicated is that almost all of our administrative work, the Commissioner's Office, our grants, things along that lines, have to flow through the Transportation Committee, which services both the Minnesota State Patrol, the finest traffic safety agency in the state of Minnesota, and I would argue the finest in the country. The Office of Traffic Safety, which is the communications and research vehicle for looking at fatal crashes and looking at how can we make our roads safer. Driver and Vehicle Services, which is the DVS program where we license register and also license drivers. The Office of Pipeline Safety, and then administration and related services are also there. So that is an overview of our department. It's a department that has a rather broad mission, and a mission that oftentimes we seem to get things added to us, sometimes by design and sometimes out of emergency. So, for example, we have seen with the number of crashes in this last year, with 500 plus fatals, 100 more fatal crashes than we'd seen the year before. That wasn't something we could have planned for. In fact, our numbers had been going in a much better direction before that. And with COVID and with many other things, we have seen fatal crashes go up. We have seen, in the last few days, having conversations with Colonel Langer about the frequency of gunplay, people shooting at each other on the state highways. Once again, not something you would normally think of in terms of traffic safety, but certainly an element that we have to now contend with as we are sending Minnesota State Troopers out there on the roads to keep the peace and keep people safe. I'll start out with our deficiency request, which actually starts out with the Minnesota State Patrol. Our deficiency request is asking for general funds to cover the cost that we've incurred from responding to civil and sometimes uncivil protests. This funding covers the costs associated with responding to both planned events, such as those that we saw last summer at the Capitol, but also unplanned events, such as events that happen in connection with Line 3, sudden attention drawn toward the governor's residence and other places where we were scrambling to try and get ahead of the issue, or at least to catch up with the issue as it stands. The request in this case is $1.89 million for fiscal year 22, and that is funding that will then allow the State Patrol to continue to operate as it's been planned. By that, I mean, for example, that we have a academy currently going on. Thank many of you that went to Ripley to see how the State Patrol trains its future peace officers. We have funding for a certain number of troopers over the course of a year. If we were not able to get the deficiency funded, that would erode the number of troopers that we would have that we could hire and that we could train. And so we believe it's very important for us to do that. The patrol does not have a budget to cover these costs, and one piece in particular I think that should be noted is that of this deficiency request, $350,000 of the deficiency request would be used to reimburse the state trunk highway fund for dollars that would have been used to cover costs of responding to these protests. The second area of deficiency is driver and vehicle services, and this is a matter around license plate mailing and production. And I will admit that it came to somewhat of a surprise to me when I talked to the dealerships and to the auto industry, because if you see the news, it seems like everybody's saying that there are no cars for sale because of the chip deficiency. And what I was told when we asked that question was just the contrary. In terms of Minnesota, they have seen a record year in terms of the number of cars sold. People are turning in their used cars, people are turning in their leases, and those cars are being resold at a much higher rate than we had seen in the past. With that increase in car sales has caused an increase in request for license plate production. Now, so we are now seeing additional requests for license plates to be produced, but at the same time that that happened, partly because of COVID and partly just I think this is the millennial age that we're in, instead of going to a dealership or necessarily going to a deputy register to request the plates, they're going online. to request the plates. Well, whereas if you had gone to a deputy register, we would have sent 100 plates to a deputy register to fulfill their needs. There's a bulk shipping cost of sending them all to that one deputy register. Now, instead of that, we are sending them to 100 different addresses. So we now are incurring mailing costs for the individual mailing of plates to people at the same time that we're incurring additional costs because we're producing additional plates. In this case, there is already a fund that supports this. So thank you for providing the fee structure that provides money to the vehicle services operating account. And so in this case, our deficiency request is requesting permission for $3,925,000 to be transferred or allow us to access that money so that we can pay for the additional production costs through MNCOR and so that we can pay for the additional mailing costs for this. We have three.
Mr. Commissioner, if you would please keep in mind, I would like to be done with your supplemental budget presentation by about 3:45. So, and I notice you got about 6 more items to go through. So I'm just trying to leave a little bit of time at the end for questions. Thank you, Mr. Commissioner.
Absolutely, I can speed this up or slow it down depending on how, at the pleasure of the chair. So we have three administered programs that DPS is seeking to have funding for. The first is one that you've heard me talk about before, which is the body-worn camera reimbursement program. It is my opinion, having been a peace officer for over 40 years, that in this day and age, body cams are the equivalent of bulletproof vests in terms of providing safety for the officer and at the same time providing chiefs of police the accountability they can use to make sure they can take corrective action if officers stray in a bad direction. By our count, there are about 9,000 officers in the state of Minnesota that don't have body cams. And so what our proposal brings forward is to create a grant program that would allow us to reimburse local departments for the cost of purchasing body cam equipment and that initial setup. That would amount to about $6 million, and if every department and every agency took advantage of this, at the end of this, they would all have body cams. Once that is done, and we are focused on departments that don't already have body cams in this case, so we are not looking at trying to replace equipment for those departments that have already expended resources to get them, but rather to make sure that those that have never been able to afford them can get them now. And then thereafter, there would be an ongoing cost of $1.5 million that would allow us to then service departments whose cameras are broken, cameras need to be serviced, or cameras need to be replaced. So there's $1.5 million there. And in that case, departments that already have the cameras would be able to do that. The second piece we're asking for is statewide law enforcement recruitment. I mentioned that the State Patrol Academy has about, I think, 14, 15 people in the academy right now. I want you to keep in mind that we had room for 60 in that academy, but 15 was what we were able to recruit and entice to come join us at the State Patrol. Every department that I've talked to, whether it's big departments and little departments, they're all saying the same things. They are really struggling to get peace officer candidates to come in. When I talked to the colleges and educational institutions, they all would say the same thing also, is that the pool of students going into those majors is also very, very thin. We believe that it is absolutely essential for the state to assist local departments in their efforts to replenish the folks that want to go into the profession, and that this effort is a statewide recruitment effort that would allow us to hire recruiters, it would allow us to help work towards advertising and other enticements, and also we believe that, much as the military did, having a fund to pay for student loan payments will also be an enticement to have individuals come into the business. The last of this is more is really more related to the fire service, but it's really related, I'd say in general, to first responders, but fire is in particular what I have in mind. I went this weekend, I was in Albert Lee for a funeral for Lieutenant Boss. He was a 38-year-old young man, prime of his life, three kids, wonderful human being, pillar of his community, had been a firefighter his entire adult life, started like literally when he was like 18 out of the fire reserves and the fire explorer program. He died of cancer. And repeatedly what I'm hearing from firefighters and fire chiefs is that cancer is taking them out far more so than burns or falls or crashes are. This would expand the eligible circumstances that families who have lost a first responder, including firefighters, who die in the line of duty to receive death benefits so that we can include cancer there. And I just really, I can tell you that in the conversations I'm having with firefighters, the chemical agents that we spray on our furniture and we spray on our walls that are fire retardants, one of the things we know is that those chemicals become cancer-causing agents in some cases. And some of them are really old technology, but we need to start responding to that. And this is a fund that would allow us to start moving in that direction. In addition to the cancer-causing agents, the other piece that we want to make sure is that we're hearing from first responders who have seen too much, and they can't unsee the unseeable, unfortunately, or the unthinkable that we send them into. And so we believe that we also need to start thinking about how do we respond when a family member has lost an individual to suicide due to post-traumatic stress disorder. And so this would be the beginning of that process. I don't know how many we're going to see apply. Cancer is particularly tricky because it's hard to determine, you know, where did the cancer come from? You know, is it a pre-existing condition? But I've had cases sitting on my desk where quite literally 2 years before, cancer-free, prime of the life, absolutely at the top of physical fitness, and within 2 years they were dying from serious cancer. And the only thing that you can attribute that to is the fact that they had been on literally thousands of fire runs. At some point, I think we need to do better by our first responders, and this is our effort to try and bring that forward. With that, I would then turn it back to Director Zhang for the next piece from DVS, unless there are questions for me.
Thank you, Commissioner. Mr. Chung.
Mr. Chair. It's me, Senator Kiffmeyer, Mr. Chair. Before we go on to something different, could I just ask a quick question of Commissioner
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you. In regards to the license plates, I've had constituents contact me and say, why do we have to get new plates every 10 years? Other states don't do that. Then they change a car and they go through all that. Is there any way that we could consider keeping our license plates longer, and this might help if we did that so you wouldn't have so much of that expense and to extend them into the 15-year realm.
Mr. Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, I'm absolutely happy to have that conversation. I would have to ask the manufacturers to try and make sure that when is the point that the plate is no longer readable or no longer viable. Is there a shelf life for that we need to worry about? And especially with Minnesota winters and salt and all the other things that we have on the cars, I would just want to make sure that whatever that time frame we have is, it fits within the kind of the mechanics of the plate construction itself. But I'm absolutely happy to have that conversation.
All right, look forward to it. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chung.
Mr. Chair, thank you. For the record, my name is Pong Zhang, Director of the Driver and Vehicle Services Division. I'll be going over the next three proposals, the first of which is the collection of race and ethnicity data. This is a joint proposal with the Office of Traffic Safety, led by Director Mike Hansen, who is on the Zoom call available for questions at the end of the presentation. This proposal is to collect race and ethnicity data and tie it to citation records, and the effort is to provide more transparency in traffic citation and ultimately build public trust. The proposal would collect the race and ethnicity data at the time of application of either a driver's license, a permit, or a Minnesota ID. We would use the census categories. The race and ethnicity data would not be presented on the credential in any form and would not be available to law enforcement. The data will be classified under as private data under Chapter 13, which would mean that we would need to specially provision the data to the Office of Traffic Safety so they can correlate it to citation data, but it will also make it available for summary reporting as available to the public, and we are prepared to have resources support those requests. The next proposal is to increase data auditing capacity. DVS is responsible for ensuring that all users of MnDrive are accessing or appropriately accessing data in MnDrive, which is highly sensitive information about all of Minnesotans. Currently, there's only one position that supports all the audits. Each of these audits are very iterative. While we identify potential misuse, the iterative process working directly with individuals and their related parties to identify whether misuse occurred or didn't occur, and ensure that, again, we are protecting the data. We're requesting two additional positions to support that work. And the third proposal is to install cameras at 24 locations and include the monitoring and management of these systems. As we're seeing across the entire service industry, there is an uptick in aggressive and violent behavior, and we believe that these cameras will not only deter or help and aid in deterring that behavior, but also provide evidence for pursuit after the fact. This proposal also includes $100,000 of reimbursement for deputy registrars who are experiencing the same customer behavior. It would be for up to $5,000 at 50% of the costs. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to have Fire Marshal Jim Smith recognized to continue the presentation.
Mr. Smith, are you online?
I am, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, I see you now. Please identify yourself for the record, with whom you are associated, and please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jim Smith. I am the state fire marshal. I also assume the role of director of Office of Pipeline Safety. I have basically one item that I'm bringing forward to the committee with one tail. You will note that in respect to the first bullet, we are requesting the removal of the civil penalty amount as defined in Minnesota State Statutes 29F and 299J, excuse me, 299F and 299J, and allow an increase in the pipeline safety civil penalty amounts to reflect the current federal pipeline safety provisions as noted in Title 49 CFR Part 190. The background for this proposal is that the current state language puts a cap on the civil penalty provisions at $100,000 for each violation for each day the violation persists, with a maximum civil penalty reaching a maximum of $1 million. MnOps has received multiple notices from the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, or PHMSA, that current Minnesota civil penalty provisions are not in compliance with the current underground natural gas storage grant guidelines. So the civil penalties in the federal agency, they tie into the grant guidelines. MnOps pretty much runs wholly on grant subsidies from the federal government. PHMSA's notified us that, quote unquote, continued failure to correct the above items will result in a loss of grant funding. They have issued this advisory in 2019, 2020, and 2021. We've been able to hold them at bay with the understanding that, one, the civil penalties currently are in state statute and they are not that easy to change. It takes a session to do a change of civil penalty amounts, and two, that I would bring these issues forward to the state legislature. So the proposed language would be to create language that automatically adopts the federal Title 49 CFR Part 190 provisions, which currently state civil penalties may not exceed $225,134 for each violation for each day, with a maximum civil penalty not to exceed $2.25 million. The initial penalty amount started out at $200,000 and $2 million, but PHMSA also injects inflationary costs, and so those amounts go up, which is the primary reason we would like to get away from specifying a dollar amount to make it the language just state that we are going to follow the federal provisions. And then the second bullet item shows that the maximum fine amount is probably not going to create a fiscal impact, because for the past 30 years, we've never really done a civil penalty over $75,000, and any civil penalty monies go into the general account, so there's no financial gain for MNOPS or anything like that. With that being said, Mr. Chair, I would stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Anything further, Mr. Commissioner?
No, sir. Mr. Chairman, pleasure to be here.
Any members have any questions? And I am not seeing any. Okay, there are no member questions. Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. Thank you, Mr. Zhang, for coming in. I would indicate that I will be sending a letter to you, Mr. Commissioner, requesting some specific information on each of your budget requests. And I would anticipate you'd get that in the next week or so, just to answer some of the more detailed questions that I would have on your budget request.
We look forward to getting your correspondence, and we'll respond as appropriate.
Thank you for coming in. Next matter on the agenda is the Metropolitan Council supplemental budget presentation by Mr. Zelli. Mr. Zelli, welcome to the committee. Excuse me. Welcome to the committee. Members, I want to just indicate to you that I have had a conversation with Mr. Zelli before the hearing. The Met Council has prepared a slide presentation, which is in your folders, and I would urge you to read it. But I have indicated to Mr. Zelli that I really don't want to take the time to go through a formal slide presentation. There are some items in the slide presentation that Mr. Zelli would specifically like to bring to your attention, and he is going to do that, but it will be a very much abbreviated presentation, with Mr. Zelli addressing his budget request for the Blue Line rail extension and the accelerated zero emissions public bus transition. And then, of course, we will also be talking about Southwest Light Rail. And I simply want the members to know the direction that we are headed as far as this hearing is concerned. And I am specifically doing my best to leave time for members to ask whatever questions that they may have of Mr. Zelli. Mr. Zelli, Chair Zelli, I should say, welcome to the committee. If you would state your name for the record, identify with whom you are associated, and proceed with your testimony. And I would like to be done with your portion, leaving about a half an hour for the members to ask you any questions that they may have. Chair Zelli.
Thank you, Chair Newman. And I am Charlie Zelli, Chair of the Metropolitan Council. I'm joined by Nick Thompson, who is the Deputy General Manager of Metro Transit in charge of capital projects. And it's my honor to present to you just some overview in a few minutes. I will not take your time with a large PowerPoint, but I will touch on a few kind of highlights as the chair has described. And then we are very open to questions. First, I will kind of just touch on a couple of things related to our budget proposals. The $200 million recommendation from the governor as an investment in the Blue Line, and then additional funding for the zero emissions transit bus procurements. As a way of background, we think about the Green Line and the Blue Line. These are the diagonal spines of an interconnected transit system. So clearly the first phases of Green Line and Blue Line are in place. Green Line extension is under construction, and this Blue Line is now having a modified alignment process through North Minneapolis, because the original route was a co-location with BNSF. That was not feasible and also not a good idea, which I'll get to in a minute from a budget point of view. But we have great confidence in this new alignment. We expect to have a route identified in 2022. This $200 million is an important funding piece, which will largely funding come from local government, Hennepin County, and federal. We are in the queue for federal grants. The funding will be used for pre-design, engineering, environmental analysis. We are, because of the realignment, we are kind of back into an environmental phase. But we, as I say, we are now on track. It was at a bit of a pause because of that BNSF alignment, but now it is up and running and I think being well received. It plays a really important role for jobs, access to those communities in the northwestern part of the metro. To get quickly to the zero emissions recommendation, this is $3.2 million to accelerate our transition toward low or no emission buses. We've had a lot of learnings about how to bring electrified buses into deployment. We now have a plan based upon available technology and what is a prudent course forward, and that was submitted to the legislature earlier this week. And I am happy to come back and discuss this in greater detail. This $3.2 million would not only help accelerate charging stations and the bus procurements, but would help leverage some of the infrastructure funding that is dedicated to this very purpose. We think that in our future, we have a combination of diesel and electric buses coming into our fleet. Again, we want to do it in a prudent way that we're not ahead of available technology, but that we're certainly making important investments for the future. I want to just segue and give a little explanation about where we are, how we got to where we are, and where we see going forward with the Southwest Light Rail, or what I'll refer to as the Green Line extension. Just as a review, again, a very important spine to this interconnected transit system, the 14 and a half miles from Minneapolis to Eden Prairie covers five communities. Important note, if you look at this map, that it is not a commuter express service. This is not something that is duplicating Southwest Transit, for instance. It is an interconnected many stations along the way, every one of them with development that's also underway. But it is both everyday commutes within these communities, and it is an important connection for the viability, economic development of this part of the metro. Most important point that you will see in the PowerPoint if you go through it is how long this plant, this transit way was under development. In the early 80s, there was early community interest planning. In fact, 1984 is when Hennepin County bought the railroad line through the Kenilworth Trail. Now, 1984 to me, and maybe some of you, seems like just the other day, but I can't believe that was nearly 40 years ago that that kind of advanced work was done to identify a transit corridor through all the way to Eden Prairie. The actual decision to become light rail was advanced through a number of decision-making planning processes where Hennepin County led an alternatives analysis, and we looked at bus alternatives, LRT, eight different routings for LRT, two bus rapid transit alternatives. So that was both a technical and a community-based decision-making. It wasn't until 2011 that the Federal Transit Administration advanced the project into engineering, and it was 2012 that Metropolitan Council took over the project at about a 1 or 2% engineering phase. So when you take over a project with a defined LRT mode and a defined locally preferred routing, that it, there's a lot of issues to be resolved. One of the biggest was the location of the freight rail TCW line. Back in that, when the early analysis came, there was a agreement, a handshake agreement, that that freight rail was going to be routed through St. Louis Park. Sadly, that was never codified, never planned, never engineered. So when it came time for the Met Council to take over the project, we were directed by the Federal Transit Administration to include freight rail in the project. More studies, and as commissioner of the Metropolitan, of the Minnesota Department of Transportation and the Dayton Administration, I certainly witnessed the studies of the feasibility of routing this freight rail through St. Louis Park. It was actually deemed infeasible, both from an engineering and cost point of view. And the TCW agreed at that time it was agnostic as to where the routing was, as long as it could be held harmless, both for safety and for cost. The St. Louis routing being infeasible, the Kenilworth Trail became the only alternative advanced by all the community hearings and interests. Because of the concern about the right-of-way, Minneapolis advanced the idea there would be no additional land offered for this transitway. So the tunnel option became the only possible engineering solution. Now, in retrospect, and I'm here not to defend but to represent how we got where we are, there's a lot of hindsights. Certainly that tunnel has presented a lot, which my neighbors have pointed out they've been warning about all along. There was engineering testing, and the feasibility determined that the tunnel, cut and cover tunnel option was reasonable. It clearly has caused one of probably the predominant issue that we're facing now in terms of costs and delays. The most important thing to consider is that the actual delays of the project going through this narrow pinch point through the Kenilworth Trail is probably the predominant reason that there's increased costs to this project. There is a secant technology that was not originally part of the design. It was deployed as an abundance of caution to ensure that it was more stable and that sheet piling wouldn't disrupt the neighboring buildings. That even that secant is a very robust construction, and it is currently halted because cracks have formed on the adjacent building, and the project team has flown in forensic engineers to evaluate those cracks, and so the actual construction around that building has temporarily halted while that assessment is underway. Very important to know that where we are now is that is an agreement with the civil contractor to have a reasonable schedule with identified costs to go forward. And it's certainly been something I've been much more engaged with, is to say, let's not kick the can down the road. In other words, let's address the issues head on. And that is why these costs are being disclosed. That's why this 34-month delay in the civil construction has been is being codified, because now we have an agreement which is resequenced to actually have a project which is achievable and where there is both and these are my words, carrots and sticks, in order to maintain cost and schedule with this new agreement. 60% constructed. It makes it very difficult, if impossible, to recover any of the costs by stopping. It would result in not only increased delays and costs associated with eventual construction, but if it was stopped completely, the nearly $1 billion that would need to be returned to the federal government, and then, of course, all the mitigation of what's already built. So it is our belief that this agreement is in the taxpayer and the metropolitan economy's best interests. We have strong support along the line. We know that this is a disruptive process. Important to note that this 34-month delay of civil construction, then we work through with the systems and we do revenue testing, that the actual construction will probably be mostly done by 2025, even though revenue service is anticipated in 2027. So we are very sympathetic to the disruption that this large and complicated project is causing. We are absolutely aghast and as disappointed as you are at these additional costs, but we recognize that we to ignore that. If we weren't to head it face on and deal with it and realistically, that it could end up with even greater costs, both to the economy, to our funders, and to the adjacent communities. So with that, I am happy to answer questions, but I do want to give in greater context. I've had the honor of actually chairing an advisory committee looking at transportation, transit costs around the country. I started that in my, what I call my sabbatical between becoming commissioner and chair of the Met Council. I had no idea I was going to be a chair of this Met Council, nor even facing this kind of situation. But I learned a lot through the Eno Foundation about costs of large and complicated transit projects. Sadly, we are not alone. There's a number of projects that have faced these kind of situations. The good news is we can learn from them, and we certainly are learning from our own experience. One thing in terms of context is that the actual cost per mile is well within reasonable parameters. In fact, it's favorable to many other projects around the country. Transit projects, particularly those that co-locate next to freight rail, those that go underground, are often presented with unseen conditions, but also are in that kind of 200 million plus per mile kind of cost structure. These are very expensive, but they are generational, and they have resulted in tremendous economic returns for the communities and for the entire metro. So that, I have spared you a 30-page PowerPoint, and I've given you Charlie Zally's highlights, and I'm willing to stand for questions with an expert witness at my side. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for that presentation. I do appreciate the fact that you moved through it quickly. Because we are going to go to member questions at this point. I don't know whether there's going to be a lot of questions or very few. I have no idea. But I do want it to allow the members ample opportunity to ask any questions of you that they may want. The one thing that I did kind of glean from your presentation is you've indicated that there is an agreement that has been reached that now allows you to move forward, and Mr. Chairman, I would be interested in seeing that agreement, if you wouldn't mind providing us with a copy of it. From what I gleaned from your presentation, number one, this is pretty reasonable cost per mile in terms of what other states may have done. In my mind, I don't agree with you. This is a horrendously expensive project. And we're talking about $2.7 billion for 14 and a half miles. And I do not know whether or not that is really the best expenditure of the taxpayers' money. The other point that I wanted to make is it almost sounds to me like you're too far in to quit. And if you do quit, we'd probably wind up with the most expensive bike trail in the nation. So I really do think that the Met Council has got some splaining to do. Mr. Chairman, you have been the chairman of the Met Council for 3.5 years. What, 8 years as chairman of, or a commissioner?
Six, Mr. Chair. Yeah.
And you came out of the private sector. So you do have experience. And at least from my perspective, I have not seen a great deal of resolution to a really nasty problem. I personally believe that the amount of money and the delays that have gone into this particular project are, almost criminal. I mean, I just cannot imagine the amount of money that has been spent on this project when what we really have in mind is to provide transit to people in the metropolitan area that need it because they don't drive. And I don't see spending this kind of money over such, a decade-long process plus, I don't see where it's really serving the public well at all. And what surprises me very honestly is on the heels of Southwest Light Rail, Met Council comes in and says, we need another $200 million to start another one. And that's going to be a pretty hard sell. With that, those are just my initial thoughts. And I do want to give the members an opportunity to ask questions. The first senator that would like to ask you some questions is Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say make a few statements. First, I want to say commend the Met Council for coming in with the request to really meaningfully start the transition to converting its bus fleet to all electric. I think that is going to be a very, very important change, certainly from a climate and environment perspective, but I think most importantly from a public health perspective, because even though the emissions profile for diesel has come down significantly, it still is a problem. Diesel emissions are, they're black and sooty and, a lot of particulates and cause a lot of health problems in highly affected and highly impacted communities in particular. So I'm really excited about that. And I just wanted, I don't want to get up on my soapbox today. You took care of that for me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do want to say that I do remember things differently. I think the audit will help us. Maybe I'm misremembering, but I think I'm right that, in fact, well, first of all, Chair Zelli talked about how the Kenilworth Corridor was purchased back in the 80s, with the idea that LRT would go through that alignment. And that, I think, members, is kind of tells us a lot of what we need to know. It was going to go along that corridor by hook or by crook, no matter. And that was decided well before a lot of the analysis and studies, environmental benefits, et cetera, even occurred. And so when more information started coming to light that, maybe there's a better route that would pick up some opportunities from better land use opportunities to intersect and interact with more potential riders, et cetera, they were dismissed. And, when information came to light that, there might be some pretty serious downsides and consequences to this alignment, those got dismissed. With respect to freight rail in particular, there actually is a law that says that once the industrial site cleanup was completed, that alignment needed to return back to its previous route. And I have I'll share that with the members. And it wasn't a handshake agreement, it was actually written down in stat. It might have been session law, it might have been codified, I'm not sure which, but I have it. And there was a study done that showed it was feasible and affordable. And I have that study too, and that was a study that wasn't going to be done. And then it was going to be done by a conflicted interest, and finally we got an objective interest to take a look. What happened was St. Louis Park said that they were going to withhold local consent. And we wouldn't even be having this conversation because there would be no Green Line Extension Southwest LRT, perhaps, if St. Louis Park was going to make good on that threat. It was a political decision to force by hook or by crook. And then a decision was made not to do the deep tunnel because of cost and delay arguments. And here we are with a lot of cost and a lot of delay. So that's what I remember. That's why I look forward to the audit request, to the point of, is $2.75 billion, maybe $3 billion still going to be worth it? maybe, you know, I'm a supporter of light rail transit because of a lot of the externalities of benefit in terms of you know, long, well, there's some internal costs that are more competitive even with buses and bus rapid transit, you know, and of course there's, you know, all the opportunities around land use and environments and regional competitive and the like. I'll also just note, members, the Blue Line extension was going to have a lot of the similar downsides in terms of alignment. It was going to go up, go down the middle of Highway 55, right down the middle of a freeway, with no real opportunities for transit-oriented development and you know, transit, you know, oriented villages, you know, pretty far away from where people could get to it. Then it was going to turn up and go right down another natural corridor, Theodore Worth, and go down another wide highway right away. It's going to be great for zipping people back and forth from one point to the other, but in terms of all the associated benefit, that is going to happen until BNSF, and that's what the county engineers and the Metro Council planners wanted, and so they were forced by BNSF to make a different decision. Now it's going to go to the heart of North Minneapolis, where you're going to get a lot of those additional social and economic and environmental benefits. And that makes me happy, but it, you know, that didn't happen because of what people were saying and wanting and pressing upon this agency to do. It happened because of an external factor. So, Mr. Chair, that's those are the points I wanted to raise. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Dibble. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the biggest thing for me is recognizing the amount of money that is being spent here and all the issues with it, and I'm sympathetic to what Senator Dibble has talked about as well, and even a new one. But I look at this, Commissioner, and I think, my goodness, how many bus rapid transit corridors could we do and could have had in place before now? Bus rapid transit is flexible, cost-effective. There's success with it on several other corridors. There's a desire for it. People actually want it. So how many bus rapid transit corridors could you do instead of going on with these light rail type things that have all, they take so long? I mean, billions of dollars. I think, you know, what is the price of a mile in bus rapid transit? What is the price of a mile in light rail?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, I think that the point of it being a very expensive, you know, structure is certainly accurate. It is extraordinary. And I would actually say Senator Newman saying he disagrees with being reasonable. I'm not actually, I guess I should say, you know, what is reasonable? The fact is that there's a return on the investment. There's a return on ABRT, absolutely. We can build an ABRT over existing roadways for $100 million, yep. $80 million, $120 million versus $2 billion or $2.5 billion, $2.7 billion. But, you know, I've learned in my 40 years managing transportation that you don't measure capital costs on a one-year basis. You measure it how it's amortized over time and then the resulting return that comes from it. These light rail lines are 60, 70 year, and then they're rebuilt. They're generational investments that actually stimulate significant adjacent investments. And we've certainly had a debate about the $2 billion of development along these 16 stations that are either built, under construction, or being planned. I've talked to those developers. I've talked to the mayors who are very enthusiastic and actually really dependent upon this permanent generational investment. Yes, very expensive, but keep in mind, these are the backbones. ABRT, the B line, has a direct connection with this green line at Westlake Street. A lot of the kind of ways that people can get around come from the interconnections to these large kind of light rail kind of investments. So I think less of them as one line is more of how do all these lines fit together. And the idea of extraordinary capital is reasonable in my mind if there's an actual return on that investment. $100 million that generates no return, that's unreasonable. So fortunately, those projects on existing roadways, which is also an investment maybe already made or being remade all the time, are very much part of this this transit vision of the future. But they don't operate in isolation. No one line can make it on its own. It has to kind of be how it connects to other lines.
Well,
thank you, Mr. Chair. I find that kind of an intriguing thing because I could apply the same thing to the BRTs and their flexibility and other things. You can have the same kind of things going on like that. But even worse than that is the disaster we have right now that was talked about earlier, warned about, not listened to, many, many, many issues where you have in bus rapid transit, you have a much more straightforward kind of construction, those kinds of things. So I respect what you're having to say. I just respectfully disagree. Thank you.
Well, and Mr. Chair, Senator, I am
Chairman Zilli.
I am hard-pressed not to try to defend this in hindsight, because I think we've had a lot of lessons learned. So we come with great humility, but also great honesty and transparency. And regarding Senator Dibble and maybe Senator Chair, comment about a legislative audit. We actually embrace that. I mean, we would love the idea of opening up. We will cooperate completely. We mm-hmm. think that understanding the complexity and ensuring that there is proper oversight, we are, and I will certainly want to embrace anything in that direction.
Well, Mr. Chair, just to finish,
Senator Kiffmeyer.
I appreciate that, but I think an ounce of prevention is better than a pound of cure. And right now, we're dealing with about a ton, and being asked at the same time for more money to start another project. This is a real problem. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
One thing I would add, Chairman Zilli, is you spoke of a return on investment and embracing the audit that is, I am certain, will be coming. I'll be pretty interested to see whether or not what you have expressed, that there is a return on investment on the $2+7+ billion investment versus, say, a $100 million BRT line having no return on investment. That'd be kind of an interesting thing to see. And there is embedded in the audit something that I requested, which is a cost-benefit analysis. Perhaps that will help us answer the disagreement that you and I are having on whether or not the return on investment of $2.7 billion is really going to be worth it in the long run.
Well, Mr. Chair and
Chairman Zilli,
I understand, but the cost-benefit return on investment that I've seen is about the system as a whole with various modes, light rail, bus, arterial bus rapid transit, how it fits together. That's where the large return toward access to employment, employees' access to employees, the reduction in congestion, without even regard to a lot of the economic development, which we've seen, witnessed on the Green Line and the Green Line extension already, that we don't see as much of with the ABRT. But the return on investment, again, comes as a system. And that's what I've seen, not just with mayors and with consultants, but with the business community who've taken a hard look at this, which is why we've gotten great support from chambers and those that are who look at large investments and returns, is part of their general practice.
Perhaps there would be a return of investment on some of the studies that you've looked at in other states that may not necessarily be appropriate in Minnesota. I don't know. And one of the things that we continually hear is, the economic development. And spending the kind of money that is being spent on this project, I really do have severe reservations as to whether you're ever going to recoup that money. The other lines that you're referring to cost about $1 billion. This one is approaching three. And you understand return on investment. I am just doubtful that the money could have been spent better in terms of providing transit, economic development, and the types of things that you're talking about by not proceeding with this. It's almost as though the Met Council is refusing to admit that perhaps there was an error and we're going to go forward no matter what. And I kind of get that feeling sometimes. So Senator Osmick wants to ask you a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple comments and then some questions for you, Mr. Zelli. Or, I'm sorry, Commissioner Zelli. I absolutely agree that the mayors in this corridor love $2 billion worth of development and are enthusiastic because the taxpayers are forking over $3 billion to create, for lack of a better term, a works project in their area. And there's no mayor alive that wouldn't like to have that level of money coming from someplace else to increase the land values on their property. So it only makes sense. I've never said mayors are necessarily stupid, but in the same respect, that's $3 billion worth of money coming out of the taxpayer's wallet someplace to make this happen. And I've said this before and I'll say it again. The economic development that is happening around this line in many ways is displaced from where it would have organically occurred within the metropolitan area. And we have had that testimony in previous iterations of this transportation committee where that has been put on the record. And I believe it to be completely true. If we hadn't built this, it would have happened someplace else, be it Burnsville, Lakeville, Egan, Maple Grove. These things would have happened because builders are looking for places to build houses, to build apartments. And all you did was create a $3 billion magnet to put them in one spot. Mayors like that. I get that. Question for you. We do know that approximately $1 billion was sent over to us by the folks in Washington, D.C. Did the Met Council even ask if it was possible for us to get a waiver on that money, finding out how many problems we had with this particular extension, finding out all of the conditions that we didn't know about before we started this? Is there been any action or any work done with the federal government to say, listen, if we decide to abandon this or turn it into a bus rapid transit or a bikeway or a trail or a garden or something like that, has the Met Council even asked that question from the federal government?
Chair Zelli.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, and I will say just one quick thing, and we can certainly revisit it later. Since initially talking to you, I've actually talked to developers who have said to me, actually, we are not building these projects except for next to a transit corridor. So I actually think that there's evidence that would suggest that this isn't going to be development that would happen anywhere. I think it actually is, and I have been convinced by the Urban Land Institute and by the developers themselves that they are there specifically building this project, and they wouldn't if it wasn't for these characteristics along a large transitway. But I invite additional scrutiny. Regarding the flexibility to convert it to a busway after it's been designed, you go through different segments, different stages along the way, which I refer you to the PowerPoint that describes these, how a alternative is chosen, how the review is done by the Federal Transit Administration. In every step of the way, they're very involved, they're still involved, and there isn't the kind of flexibility to kind of switch a total redesign. I'm not saying that that's not possible, but it is a very significant shift once you're into the engineering. But I will defer to the capital expert here to answer that.
Mr. Chair, Senator, for the record,
Mr.
again,
Thompson.
Nick Thompson, Metro Transit. So FTA has expressed to us over and over again, they want to see this project finished. They invested in this project and they see the value in the project. So that has been their stance that they've talked to us about. They're right now, these projects nationally that are facing challenges like ours with the new infrastructure bill, there might be more opportunity for federal funding to come to this project and to change the federal mix. But they've expressed to us that this is the right project. It's went through a process to develop the best alternative here, and their investment supports the alternative that's being built is how they phrased it to us.
Senator Osmak.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. So to try and get it into a yes or no answer here, because I didn't hear an answer to the actual question that I could discern, has the Met Council approached the federal government, Federal Transit Authority, to ask for a waiver on the night if it's possible for us to be waived from not paying back the $1 billion that we got from them if we chose to abandon or change the project?
Chair Zelli.
Mr. Chair, Senator, that question to the FTA is not one that that I'm aware is one that they would actually receive. But I defer to.
Correct, Mr. Chair. We have not asked that question for this.
Chair Zelli, the question wasn't whether or not the federal government would accept the question. The question is whether or not you made it.
Mr. Chair, we did not ask a question that that we were not ever seeing as an opportunity to ask.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Osmak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, it just continues to get worse, because if we can't look at alternatives, there's a bill voting, I believe, coming to strip this entire project away from the Metropolitan Council. Because I agree with Senator Dibble, my God, that's the second time in a week, that this project has been so poorly managed by the Metropolitan Council, not always in your watch, Commissioner, Metropolitan Council Chair. This project has been so completely mismanaged that we as the legislature, I don't know if we can trust that it's going to actually take place, much less take place in a reasonable fashion. It'll go over $3 billion. So I would suggest to you, Commissioner, to Chair Zelli, I keep thinking of you of your previous role.
Appreciate that.
You might want to ask that question, because they may not want to listen and they may say no, but if you don't ask the question, we're not doing our job from a legitimate standpoint of a public project that has gone off the rails, pun intended. So another question, and then I'll leave it to my other colleagues to speak. You talk about lessons, learn from our lessons. We're learning everything as we go. This is why I get frustrated. We're now here listening to you ask for $200 million more for the next rail line, when we haven't even learned our lesson from this one. How can you assure the taxpayers of Minnesota, or the constituents here in the great state of Minnesota, that you have learned your lesson? You've got a project that is completely off of its finances. It has gone through so many iterations. Senator Dibble is right about the condo that now has cracks. We don't know about that. I've heard about a warehouse that is now unusable. We're finding out more and more. Bear with me. This actually came from Senator Dibble, I think. But how can we trust that this next extension line, after we haven't even learned our lesson from this episode, how can we trust as a legislature that the Met Council can properly manage or even deliver on the next line in a reasonable fashion at a reasonable dollar figure without it being another boondoggle? How can we trust this?
Chair Zelli.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think that's a reasonable question. And I think that to have this kind of cost increase, this kind of settlement agreement, and the kind of disruption through this narrow corridor, which is where I live, by the way, how can we trust? And I understand that. And I actually, the due diligence that I have come to as a former commissioner is, what do you do with a situation which was a slow process that started 40 years ago, and it ended up for a whole number of reasons, which I highlighted, and I'm happy to have as much scrutiny on this record as possible. But I think the learning comes when you actually choose the alternative, which is there's a process for that. And when you actually contract, the procurement process of how you put together the right kind of governance and contracting, it's where you set these projects up at the very beginning. Those are when there's actually cost and much more alternatives. And that's where I say the learnings need to be brought forward. I also point out, nothing to do with me, that this agency delivered a number of different transit projects on time and below budget. And this one is a particularly difficult, complex, the largest one, absolutely. But the other green lines, the other blue line, the transit ways, have had a much different experience. So I think there is the capacity and the expertise. And I say that as an outsider. And I've seen it nationally. They have always had great compliments, not just FTA, but the Federal Highway. And as commissioner, I heard that Minnesota knows how to deliver projects. I have, as commissioner of transportation, encountered a number of different, very difficult construction issues. They happen even in roadways. And some of the expert consultants, a number of them, including MnDOT, who have been brought into this project already, have actually scrutinized and are helping second guess and to ensure, from my due diligence, that this kind of rebaselining settlement is a reasonable one. And that's the one that I have been engaged with. How we got here is difficult, and there are lessons learned. These decisions were made many years ago. Let's get it right. I think the blue line is under a right course, but and it plays a really significant role for our economy and our metro area. I think your question is completely reasonable, and we'd love the opportunity through additional disclosure, transparencies, explanation, tours, OLA audits, to build at least trust by disclosing what's really going on. And I hope and am available to help describe whatever that is.
Senator Coleman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I'm thrilled that the Met Council has the luxury of being able to learn these lessons and then come back to the legislature and ask for millions of more dollars to make up for these lessons. But everyone sitting up here doesn't have that luxury, because when we want millions of more dollars and we have to be stewards of the taxpayers, we have to answer to them. Nobody has to answer for those dollars within the Metropolitan Council. Nobody is accountable to the taxpayers, and I think that is a huge disservice to Minnesotans. What I want to know is, why are we still pursuing these light rail projects when, for example, Southwest Transit has an impeccable line that's 30 minutes faster to downtown than light rail is going to be? It's on coach buses. It has Wi-Fi. They have Southwest Prime, which will go pick up people at their homes if they need help getting to the bus service. And they now see the light rail as competition for these high-functioning, amazing services for the community. If we are to be stewards of the taxpayers, whom we actually have to answer to, shouldn't we be investing these dollars into local communities to do these routes which are less disruptive to the environment? They're easier to cater to the unique needs of each community, and they're easier to change as communities grow and change. Aren't those a better use of tax dollars?
Chair Zelli.
Mr. Chair, Senator Coleman, the Southwest Transit, as I mentioned, is an express route. Mm-hmm. It runs right from Eden Prairie directly to downtown. The Green Line extension is not it goes to those same endpoints, but there's 16 stations. It goes every 10 minutes all day long. It's not just a morning commute and an afternoon commute. It is a very different kind of transportation service. I'm in the bus business. I went down to a Jefferson Lines bus that was full leaving Kansas City at 7 in the morning, and there was an airline price war. You could actually pay less money to take a plane from Kansas City to Minneapolis. And I was scratching my head thinking, I'm grateful, but why are there so many people in this bus when you can get cheaper to Minneapolis by taking a plane? Well, the plane was just going to Minneapolis. The bus was making connections every step of the way. And at Des Moines, you could go turn left and go to Omaha. You can go to a lot of little towns. There's a lot of travel shed to this area, a lot of interconnecting points. It's not Express, it's just a different service. Regarding the investment, light rail is, again, the backbone to which many other transit kind of bus systems are a part of, connect to. We think that this generational, very expensive projects actually have a return, and they have shown that in other cities, and they've shown that in our city. If you look at the Green Line, the success of on University Avenue, you look at the Blue Line, how it's going from Mall of America all the way to downtown, not just events, commutes, everyday living. We actually believe the transit of the future is a connection of this web of services. It is not just going from one place to the next. The express routes in the Metro Transit Service, and I'm sure this is true with the Southwest as an example, were down as much as 90%, 95% ridership drop during the pandemic. Light rail and our regular buses maybe down 50%, maybe 55%. You know, there are people, 90 to 100,000 people a day taking buses. And people are commuting because they could telecommute. We're not taking.
Or North Star down 90, 95%.
And North Star, exactly. North Star as well. Absolutely. The North Star is more of a commuter in the morning, in the afternoon, point to point. So it's just a different service.
Mm-hmm. Senator Coleman?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, just a quick comment. I think that a lot of these issues could be solved if there was less control from the Met Council and Metro Transit over this regional transit system. And I've personally ridden them. I think they're a much better option, and I think the community members there highly agree. And I agree with you. It is a generational investment in that my children's children will be paying for this if it keeps going along this route. So thank you.
Senator Pratt.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I know we're getting late, so I'll be brief. Senator Osmick and Senator Coleman touched on some of the points. I can't help but get over this concept of rate of return. And I'm an old finance guy. If I invest $100 and I make $1,000 and I get $1,000 back, I make $900, you know, 9-to-1 return. That's awesome. If I invest $1 million and I get 1.1 million back, I've made $100,000, way more than I made in my other investment, but the rate of return is much, much less. And I believe, just looking at University Avenue still today, that a lot of the economic benefit that's being counted is on the back of economic loss from businesses that couldn't survive that construction period. And that concerns me. Mr. Chair, I was looking at the ridership numbers that was talked about. Light rail is at about 50% of its pre-pandemic. You mentioned the commuter rail. And while the buses are down, occupancy rates in the Twin City offices are up. Occupancy rates are about 40% above kind of the normal level. Normal level, as I look at the a Vision Young report, typically run about 8%. We're at 11.3%, which is about a 40% increase over where we're typically at. It seems to me that the assumptions used on light rail don't fit today's world. And Senator Osmick and I came in 2013. We knew this project was going to be over budget when we came in. The assumptions were flawed. But it seems one of the main problems, Commissioner, is that the Met Council has a systemic conflict of interest. You're the MPO and you're the operator of Metro Transit. And you're displacing a competitor in Southwest Transit by, as the MPO, directing the resources to the very operation that you're in charge of, that you operate. And I think we have to take a serious look at that conflict of interest, Mr. Chair, because it's hurting the taxpayers in the metropolitan area.
Thank you, Senator Pratt.
Mr. Chair, Senator.
I'll come back to you just one moment, Mr. Chairman. I'm not seeing any other questions from any members. I'll come back to you, Mr. Chairman, and then I get the final word.
All right.
Mr. Chairman Zelli.
Mr. Chair, I and just Senator Pratt, I I think that is an issue about governance and our role as acting as an MPO, which is really really designated to a transportation advisory board, has been studied at length. We're continuing to happy to study it. I refer you to the latest Blue Ribbon Committee that studied it a year and a half ago. But I think that the point here today is that these large systems are as valid now as when they were originally advanced. We're not coming to say defensively everything was perfect with Southwest Right Rail. This is the largest, this is the most complicated. All the other lines, I think, went well, under budget, on time. It doesn't always happen. And this one, I think, has had a series of unfortunate events, and I'm here to, I think realistically, from my view, what is reasonable given the circumstances we're in. And I'm happy to go back and have greater scrutiny. We invite it. But knowing that these transit systems over time, we believe, are not just 100,000 benefit on a million. It is several more million based on that first million. So there is return, economic and benefits felt by the livability of a state, the competitiveness of our state, the taxpayers of our state, and I'm happy to direct ourselves to arithmetic that would help make that case. I know we had differences of opinion. I do appreciate the opportunity to present to you today. I know that you are looking at it with the mind to do what the best interests of the taxpayers do as well, and I really appreciate the opportunity to visit with you today.
Chairman Zelli, I just want to express my appreciation for the fact that you came in personally to talk to us. I also appreciate the time that you shaved off of your presentation to give these senators an opportunity to ask you some pretty tough questions and express some opinions that don't dovetail well at all with your own. I will tell you personally, I have serious doubts as to whether the return on investment on this particular line, let alone the others, is worth it. I really have not seen that proof. I am not a finance guy like Senator Pratt, but I do understand investments a little bit, and I'm just honestly, I am not seeing it. The final thing that I would say, Mr. Chairman, is with respect to the Met Council's supplemental budget request, as with MnDOT, DPS, I will be submitting a letter to you asking you for some detailed information on what is encompassed in your request. And as I've indicated before, I'm not nearly as interested in the category or the slot that the money is being slid into. I'm much more interested in what you're actually going to spend the money on, and that will be the direction of the letter that I will be sending to you within the next week or so. With that, Chair Zelli, again, thank you very much. We have now completed our business, and we are adjourned.
Thank you.